This is Limitless Possibility. I'm Yannick Magnan.
And I'm Luc-Olivier Dumeblé.
And our topic this week is...
We'll go back on a couple of topics that we were not supposed to talk again. But yes, we'll talk about the PlayStation VR event, some video games news. After that, we'll talk a little bit about the Apple event. And the main topic for today will be modern web browsers and which one of them is the new IE.
Oh my god. I've been looking forward to this discussion. But first of all, we have a little bit of follow-up. On episode 24, we were talking about Twitch and YouTube gaming and weird stuff that people put up on Twitch and YouTube gaming. And in the last 2 weeks, there has been this new thing. Have you heard of GTA San Andreas animal cameras?
Animal cameras?
Yeah. So what they did is they modded GTA San Andreas. There is some wildlife in that game, and they basically modded the game so that the camera would just follow the AI animals around while they ate grass and stuff, and you can go watch them on Twitch while they wander around the city.
Wow, that's interesting. Yep. This reminds me of an article I've seen recently that they were showing a goose? No, it's a moose, if I recall correctly, in GTA 5. And I don't know why, but every like video game website was tweeting about it.
Right. So anyway, that happened.
Yeah, that was weird.
Next up, you've got some news on PlayStation to share. Well, I guess it's more of a topic than follow-up because we're going to have a lot of it.
Good. During our last episode regarding video games, we mentioned that we were recording a little bit early just before the PlayStation VR event that was happening on March 15. And during this event, Sony announced, I would like to say the release month and not the release date, and plus the prices of the PlayStation VR. Obviously, they also released all of the tech spec of it and all of the details everyone was waiting for it. So let's start with the price. The price is $399 USD or $549 Canadian. And that's for the default bundle. The default bundle will include only the PlayStation VR headset and its hardware, and a small caveat that Sony announced kind of on the side because journalists started to ask questions is the VR requires the PlayStation camera, and it seems that the moves, the PlayStation move, are optional. It's either they are required in some games or the DualShock will be required because the light on them will also be used to track both devices. So the PlayStation camera is used to track your head, and the PlayStation VR will also pull some lights, and the DualShock has the same feature behind its back, and it will also use those features. Obviously, Sony will have a launch bundle priced at $499 in the US and $699 in Canada, and obviously this bundle is kind of the bundle you want to buy if you want to be ready for VR. So it includes the VR headset and all of its cables and accessories, the PlayStation camera, a pair of PlayStation Moves, and PlayStation VR Worlds, which is kind of a demo game for PlayStation VR.
And I believe included with both the standard bundle and the other bundle, there's PlayStation Playroom VR or something. It's some other pre-installed software that basically builds off of the Playroom application, which comes with every PS4 except adds VR support for it, so you can do that as well. I never even launched Playroom on my PlayStation 4, so I'm not too sure what it is. Just I know that it comes with it and that people were using it to stream themselves having sex on Twitch for a while. It's like a kind of photo booth thing for a PS4, and people were using it plus the share feature to basically share whatever the hell they wanted, and that ended it tragically on Twitch.
Okay, because I was about to ask, what is this app on the PS4 that I never heard about?
And then you just mentioned it's buried deep, deep, deep in the library, but technically I believe every PS4 owner has it. Or maybe it's only if you get the PlayStation camera. Because I don't think there's much of a point if you don't have the camera. But that software is also coming with the PlayStation VR. I'm very glad that they seem to be going in the direction of selling the PlayStation VR at cost in order to build up an install base to make it more tempting for developers. than to sell it at a more extreme price, like maybe their other competitor, which we might talk about in a little bit, Oculus, which launched this week.
Yep, and I think it drives back to the point we were both making during the PlayStation episode, was either they will play in the same prices, or they'll try to undercut their competition by being a little bit lower, and that's what they did. And the media was kind of reporting that they are either selling at cost but are with a small profit. Like, nobody was clear about that. But Sony was kind of proud to say that they were able to, like, ship them and it won't lose money on them and blah, blah, blah. Regarding shipping, they have started pre-orders already with a launch date of October 2016. And that's what I meant with launch month and not launch date. So they mentioned that they kind of want it really around the holidays 2016 period. And that's kind of genius if they're not ready yet. Like, waiting for the holiday periods and make sure that they are able to maybe sell their story for PlayStation VR in the meantime to prepare the holiday season, where I don't have numbers to back that up, but it feels to me that the holiday season is the biggest season where people will buy video game stuff.
Yeah, definitely.
On a developer side note here, Polygon reports that Sony will be quite strict about the quality and user experience of the PlayStation VR games that will go through the PlayStation VR game certification process. Senior staff engineer Chris Norden said during the presentation, quote, "You cannot drop below 50 FPS, period, ever. I can't stress that enough."
60, not 50.
Oh, I said 50? Oh, it's, yeah. Even... Okay, so 60, sorry about that. But Sony wants to make sure that everybody's enjoying the best VR experience that they can provide, and they will make sure that maybe we don't have any, like, B-quality software for VR. Maybe the game won't be that great, but they want to make sure that you don't feel any, like, expected downside of the VR experience.
Basically, they don't want people to have motion sickness.
Right. Obviously, that's the main problem with VR, is motion sickness. And to cope with that, he also mentioned that Sony will be open to provide some kinds of PR VR consultation service. It was kind of vague what this consultation service would be.
My understanding of how this works is it's very similar to how, if you're an iOS developer and you have contacts within Apple's developer contacts, basically the tech evangelists and all that stuff, it's very similar to that, but for PlayStation VR, where you can show your game internally at Sony and they will give you feedback on that stuff. It's not something that necessarily all of us in the iOS development community have experienced, because some people are much bigger developers than others and have more of a need for that kind of contact than smaller developers, but it's certainly something that has an analog in a world we're familiar with.
Yeah, exactly. And it feels like Mr. Norden made it clear that this service won't be a beta testing from Sony, more like you mentioned, guidelines, help developers to not fall into common pitfalls or issues, and just stay vague enough while suggesting that it won't be required to go through, but it's highly suggested.
And like a lot of the consoles have some kind of certification test before allowing games to enter their stores, I'm expecting PlayStation VR to basically have the same round of tests that they would do for you if you submitted your game ahead of time. I imagine it's the same suite of tests that they would run through during certification, except then it's probably too late to actually fix it, because you might have already announced the release date by that time and all that stuff. So you really want to hit that checklist. And that's why I think it's a really, really useful service for developers who are working on VR games. Not that we know anybody who is.
Good. Lastly, before we move on from the PlayStation VR, I would like to know, because I think I didn't ask you that, but did you pre-order one?
I have not. I am considering it. The main problem is, with a lot of gaming console related stuff, especially gaming hardware, I tend to not pre-order those things because I have this terrible fear that every game I care about will be delayed, and then I'll buy the hardware and I'll have no games for it, or only games I'm not interested in will be out. So I'm waiting for more information on the release window for the games that I'm interested in before I actually make a move. But if I knew for a fact that all the games I'm interested in were coming out at launch, then I would go for it immediately.
Good. And still not planning to pre-order it. I do hope, by the way, that the launch bundle will stay as an like more like premium bundle for people like me that haven't bought any PlayStation Move or the PlayStation camera. But we'll see in the future.
Yep.
Next, let's go into the rumor land for a couple of minutes. In the last few days, video game journalists started to report that Sony might be working on a new version of the PlayStation 4. The new version, nicknamed PS4K, should be more powerful to drive the PlayStation VR and PlayStation VR game, and as its nickname suggests, should also support 4K resolution. And I'll be honest here for a sec, and I wasn't expecting that to happen so fast. And obviously, it's still a rumor. We don't know. Nothing has shipped yet. But the link that we'll post in the show notes suggests, and it's from Walkthrough Journal, that this new console should get introduced right before the PlayStation VR launch in the next holidays. Suggesting that it should be like the right companion for your PlayStation VR setup. And part of what I think is compelling about Sony's solution to VR is the fact that it runs on the normal PS4 on kind of non-exciting hardware, to be honest. And if they're able to keep that and also say, like, oh, if you want to like the ultimate VR experience, you should buy this new console which supports 4K, I think Sony will run into the same issues that Nintendo is running into right now with the new 3DS. They will have like two consoles of kind of the same generation, and then hopefully it will be more clear to know which one you should get and why is it still okay to keep your old console, quote unquote old console. And maybe PlayStation VR will be a good reason and save this premise of a mid-cycle PlayStation 4 revision. But let me be a little pessimistic about that.
So I'm not entirely convinced that these rumors are exactly as accurate as people think they are. I think that there is some amount of sense in Sony releasing a PS4 with 4K capabilities because they have a video delivery service for 4K that nobody is using because it's not supported on any devices anybody owns. So that's sort of a problem. And if they want to push their video delivery service in 4K to people who have 4K television so that they can watch 4K movies instead of watching crappy 1080p movies upscaled to 4K, which has no point, then they might as well just release PlayStation that's capable of using that. I am not entirely convinced that the this new PlayStation would be able to play games in 4K. At the very least, I expect it to be running at a lower internal resolution and then upscaling that to 4K. But I don't think native playback in 4K is reasonable for a console, unless they make it really, really expensive. And if they do that, that's perfectly fine. They're allowed to do that and have like this premium PS4 for people with 4K TVs. But the problem is the existing games won't necessarily work at that resolution, I'd imagine. They would have to either ship updates or get re-releases, HD remasters of the HD remasters. We really want that.
At this point, it would be like the Ultra HD remaster of the HD remaster.
Yeah, we're basically like in an infinite looping hell of HD remasters right now, and I can't wait until we get out of it and we move on to the actual new games. Of course, judging by your game library, you don't agree with that statement. But, so I'm not entirely sure that it's going to be as big of a deal as people make it out to be. The other thing that we need to note here is that even if the PlayStation 4K supports 4K in theory, it's not going to make your PlayStation VR suddenly 4K. It's basically half of 1080p right now on per eye for the PlayStation VR, and that resolution isn't magically going to get better. You're just going to get more cycles to maybe hit the target frame rate of 120 frames per second more often than you would on traditional PlayStation 4 hardware. And the other thing, and this will bring us sort of tying into something I'm going to talk about a little later, is fundamentally all of this stuff is just PC hardware, and PC games for many years have had multiple levels of detail settings and all of that stuff that you can toggle on and off. And I think if Sony has sane standards where they say, well, if you're on this console, use these settings, if you're on that console, use these settings, that the whole thing is seamless instead of requiring the user to go in and tweak those settings, then I think there's no real problem to it. That's sort of how the new 3DS works with hybrid games. The big worry I'm seeing online is there going to be some game library that is just available to this new PlayStation? And I doubt it. Clearly, that hasn't worked very well for the new 3DS, because there are basically two or three titles that are exclusive to the new 3DS and Super Nintendo emulation. And neither of those are particularly compelling. What is much more compelling is sort of the enhanced versions of existing 3DS games that run much better. So I don't know. I'm not going to buy it.
Sure, and that's kind of my point of like being pessimistic about it, is most game developers would want you to get the new one. Obviously, because in some cases it will make their lives easier to develop those games and maybe bring even more nicer features to their games because they have the computational power to do them. But you still have to think about the quote-unquote slower PS4 the same way as the same way we kind of still have to manage to get our iOS application to run on iPad 2s semi-fast.
Well, the other thing I'm worried about is, what if this PlayStation 4 is really like an iPad 3 and it's just like, yeah, it's barely capable of handling 4K, but we released it and now we have to deal with it. I mean, I'm not expecting to have my mind blown by this PS4. I'm really expecting it to be primarily 4K compatible for video purposes and much less for gaming purposes. I just can't see that, especially when PC gaming right now, the standard resolution, even in PC gaming, is 1080p. So it would be really, really ballsy of them to say, we're doing 4K gaming. I'm not saying they're not going to do it, but it's unlikely, highly unlikely.
Agreed. So I think we covered what we had to say about Sony. Yep. So next point, let's talk about Oculus, which also had a big week.
Yeah, they launched.
Yep. So they released on March 28th, which is 2 days ago. And everybody around the internet is having their unit and having fun with them. We've seen one of the demo and one of the games that I've seen some like videos of people interacting with is Project Cars, that got an update for Oculus Rift, which brings back to my point of if any Gran Turismo games supports flawlessly the PlayStation VR, I think I will just have to insta buy that shit.
Have you seen the video of the guy moving around in Project Cars with the HTC 5? Because it's hilarious.
Yeah, where he moves to the passenger seat and then you see just like his head chops and...
Yeah, you can see basically the driver is still sitting in the seat, but because the user has moved his head away from towards his body, then you just see like the body without a head. And it's very, very disturbing.
Yeah, because it's only the head of this fictional character that moves around and not the whole body.
Classic Ubisoft.
But that was so funny. It's like you can just see like a headless corpse driving a car at like 200 kilometers per hour, which is quite funny.
Yeah, but it still sort of shows that all of this VR gaming stuff is still an experimental place where people haven't quite figured out what are the implications of being able to freely move the camera around or all that stuff. Yeah, so I think Oculus reviews have mostly been really positive. I haven't seen anything below an 8 out of 10 from most gaming websites and prominent YouTubers. So looks like people are really enjoying it. A couple of things I feel like should be mentioned. We mentioned earlier that the PlayStation 4 PlayStation 4 is requiring 60 frames per second. The requirement on Oculus is 90 frames per second minimum, which is a step up. It's pretty nice. Of course, this is on PC gaming with some pretty hefty rigs, so they are able to do a lot more than PS4 might be possible. But whatever, your mileage may vary. That's sort of the problem with Oculus.
And by the way, is it me, or it should be kind of a little bit easier to just like circumvent that if you want to just be lazy and ship at 60 with Oculus compared to PS4? Because you still need to go through the certification process for Sony consoles and all of that stuff. Compared to PC, you can just ship it and that's it.
Right, so the way Oculus works is it's similar to how Chromebooks have a development switch on the side. So there's a hardware switch you need to toggle on your Oculus so that you can allow games out from outside the Oculus store to work. So Oculus still has their approval process where they actually verify if you ever drop below 90 and then they reject you. But if you want to use any game from Steam or from any other third-party store on the internet or from a developer directly or from development environment, you just flip that switch and then all bets are off. The reason it's a physical hardware switch is because, again, there are health concerns. If you get motion sickness from VR, you can be out for a good 2 or 3 hours from what I've heard in reviews.
So wow, okay, that's good.
It's a public health concern more than anything else, and that's why it's a physical hardware switch. It's not necessarily ecosystem control.
But that can be quite bad. Wow. Oh, I didn't know it was that bad, to be honest.
I'm not sure I want to experience it, but yeah.
Yeah, me neither. But just to maybe quickly move on from Oculus, something we heard during the release this week is the Oculus Touch motion control should be released in the second half of 2016. Meanwhile, the Oculus Rift is shipping with the Xbox controller that you can use on your PC or Xbox. Because Microsoft announced a while ago that it will support the Oculus Rift.
It doesn't right now, though.
It doesn't, but it will support, right?
It's supposed to, yeah.
Yeah, okay. And lastly, we put an article from Polygon in the show notes that is kind of a short list of launch titles and the opinion of the Polygon art writer that I forgot to mention because I don't have their name. Is our name on end, but they go through a list of a launch title and just give you a small summary and what they like and don't like about them.
And what's also very interesting is Oculus, for all of the games that are released on their platform, they give a game a comfort level, which is something PlayStation doesn't appear to be doing, but it's still kind of early to determine that stuff. But basically it tells you roughly how long you can expect to keep the headset on without feeling fatigued. So something like Project Cars, you can maybe only play for like 15 minutes at a time before you have to rest your eyes because it becomes a little overwhelming because of the speed of how things are going. On the other complete opposite, there are some basically point-and-click adventure games which require very little effort because you're not really moving the camera a lot. So that has I think it's called comfortable rating. So that's a really interesting thing that a lot of people probably haven't even considered is those ratings might actually be really useful in determining whether or not a game is viable at all for you in VR.
Yeah, and I was watching, I think it's the Digital Foundry YouTube video you sent me recently.
So
the Digital Foundry was doing their review of the Oculus Rift, and the guy was showing some of the launch titles, and also explaining how some of those launch titles make you experience those comfort level. Even some of them where one of them is you can walk around in a quote-unquote open world type of game where you can just then put it in comfort mode and then it just becomes like you need to press left arrow to go left or right and then it will just like move the character faster and it's kind of like using movie clips to make the animation go a little bit faster and make it more comfortable to play with it.
All right, let's talk about Xbox, which Microsoft basically is holding day one of their build conference today when we're recording this. And I was watching the keynote because it could be somewhat related to my job in certain cases. And unfortunately, today's keynote had nothing to do with my job, but it had a lot to do with Xbox and the Universal Windows platform.
So it had a lot to do with your other job, which is this podcast.
Professional gaming, yes.
Whoa, I was mentioning the podcast, not professional gaming.
It's the same thing. I game for this podcast so we can talk more about video games on this podcast and make people sick of hearing about video games. So as we mentioned previously, there was a Forza game, Forza Motorsport 6 Apex, which was announced for Windows 10. And the studios who developed that game, Turn 10 Studios, said that moving forward, all of their games are going to be shipping on both Windows 10 and Xbox as part of the Universal Windows platform, which is the big push that Microsoft is making in today's keynote, is you can develop a Windows application once and run it everywhere. If you've heard this before and are sort of worried, I understand. But basically, you write one modern Windows app and you can access it across a continuum of devices on your phone, on your tablet or PC, and on the Xbox. And they've done a couple things. The first is they've released a converter for legacy Windows applications, which also works for games. So they had demoed that earlier in the keynote with some boring enterprise applications or whatever, saying, hey, you can convert these apps into universal apps and you can use Visual Studio as a universal app. You can watch. So yeah, it's crazy. But you can also do this for Win32 games. So games that have Steam builds, they demoed it with Age of Empires 2 HD, or even stuff like The Witcher 3. You just dump it into the converter and magic happens, and voila, you've got a game that supports live tiles, notifications, Xbox One controller support. I am really curious to know how the hell this works, because I don't believe it one bit.
The only thing it did for me was reminding me that Age of Empires 2 still exists. I was so happy about that, but that's another point.
As a developer, it really worries me as in general that more and more Microsoft seems to be turning towards a, we made a giant converter, you throw a binary and another binary comes out the other side approach. That sounds really, really dangerous and not a good approach, but Microsoft is going all in, it seems. So that is one thing they announced today. The other thing is super interesting, and it's called Xbox Dev Mode, and allows you to turn your retail Xbox One into a development kit so you can deploy games to your own personal Xbox via Visual Studio and then submit them for inclusion in the Xbox Store. So that is also really interesting. It harkens a little bit to XNA indie games on the Xbox 360, which we mentioned on the Xbox episode. And also, it reminds me a little bit of PlayStation Mobile, which is dead, but was on the Vita and allowed you to do basically the same thing. So really nice to see those things announced over on the Microsoft side. Whether or not it will save the Xbox is a whole other thing. But hey, it's cool, I guess.
It is.
Yeah.
Hey, okay, and also, I can add something on my library of remastered HD stuff.
Ooh. Oh, no.
Okay, let's move on from video games now.
All right, let's talk about Nintendo, although I don't really want to, given what happened a couple hours before the recording of this podcast.
Right. I kind of forgot that we wanted to talk about Nintendo. Poor Nintendo. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, so unfortunately, a couple hours before we started recording the podcast, news came out that Allison Rapp, which was a marketing employee over at Nintendo's Treehouse and Nintendo of America, who has been harassed by Gamergate for months now, lost her job today. And it's really sad to see her go. Of all the companies that are in the gaming industry, the last one you would expect to basically ditch someone because of the whims of Gamergate is Nintendo, but they've done it. So it really pisses me off. So I'm going to keep this brief, I guess. Miitomo came out in Japan two weeks ago? Whatever. It came out fairly recently. It's coming out, I believe, on Friday here in North America and in Europe. And it's basically exactly what I expected it to be. It is not very captivating. It is ask.fm with Miis. It doesn't have very much staying power. In fact, the only staying power it really has is it gives you free reward points for My Nintendo, which you can use to buy real video games on the Nintendo 3DS and Wii U. And I did that. I bought WarioWare Touched with reward points, and now I have purchased every single reward I can buy on My Nintendo for the 3DS, so I am going to just keep on building on those points until the next rewards go up. I wrote a blog post about it on my blog. I'm going to link it in the show notes so we don't spend too much time on it. But yeah, Meet 'Em All, it's out. And
lastly, we have the best news from Nintendo.
Oh my god.
Did you heard that Nintendo sold tons of Wii U last week in Japan?
Oh yeah, how many?
4,500. Oh wait, it was not tons of them.
No.
Just 4,500. Yep, so as a, just like a funny joke from the Wii U again, on the Wii U again. Yeah, the sales of the Wii U are not so great these days, especially in Japan.
Well, we should also mention that technically last week also brought us the rumor that the Wii U is going to be ending production very soon, and the NX is currently starting to be manufactured for a holiday release. So there might also be that involved.
Right. But at least Nintendo can be happy that they're not the last console on the list, which is the Xbox One at 55 consoles for Japan.
Poor Xbox One.
Yeah, so I thought it could be a funny way to end our video game segment for this week.
All right, so let's move on to the Apple event.
Yep. To move away from our typical like 2 hour long episode about the Apple event, I've decided that this week Yannick and I would do three like interesting points, or three our best three things. I don't know. We've decided our own list, but it's just 3 points. We want to keep them short, and let's get started on those.
Do you want to alternate? Like, you do one, I'll do one.
Yes, sure. I can start. Awesome. First one, which for me is new Apple Watch bands. So
I've got one on my wrist right now.
Oh, I do too, but it's not the same that you're wearing right now. But more on that later. So during the keynote, Apple announced a couple of new bands. They announced new woven nylon bands in 7 colors, and those are priced as they are the same price as the sport bands. Also, there are new colors in most lineups. Apple called their new lineup the Spring 2016 lineup to more fit with the styling industry and all of that stuff. So they added tons of new color for the sport bands, and they added new leather colors for the classic buckle, the leather loop, and the modern buckle. And lastly, they added the space gray Milanese loop. It is so pretty. I went to the Apple store over the weekend, and it is so pretty. And why is it a high point for me for this keynote is I was expecting an update, and also was like on the verge of buying new bands. I was like, oh, maybe I should just wait a month and see what will be announced in the next Apple event. So I wouldn't say that I'm not surprised that they had not announced a new version of the Apple Watch, but it feels to me that they want to wait to a bigger event. It didn't feel that they are either ready for it to be shipped or announced, or just want to wait maybe the new OS, and the new OS will bring new feature. So it feels to me that it's either something that we'd be announcing at WWDC in June, or at the typical like September October event where they announce tons of new stuff. And also the fact that Apple is kind of regular on updating the band's lineup shows that if you want to have an Apple accessory of a specific color, you can have 4 to 6 months to buy it. And the best example of that is my personal experience over the weekend at the Apple store. I'm a great fan of last year green's accessories from Apple, which is kind of a flashy green. And like I mentioned, I was waiting for the band lineup update. And when I went to the Apple store to buy some of them, I realized that even in the iPhone and iPad cases, some of the colors previously available are just gone, like totally gone. And the best example of that is right now what it's called the green sport band, which is the best way I can put it to without showing you a picture is imagine you have RGB color and you just put zero everywhere unless and green at 255. So it's kind of real flashy. And during the spring lineup update, they added a new mint sport. Like its name suggests, it's more a mint green than a flashy green. And this flashy green color is gone from iPad cases and iPhone cases, and I feel that it will be the same for those sport bands. And lastly, just for the curious, the two other bands that I bought was the yellow sport and the black woven nylon, which I'm gladly surprised by the new nylon bands. They are really comfortable and at the same price as sport bands, feel way better if you plan to wear your Apple Watch all day long. Like compared to the sports band, when those feel like they don't breathe enough, like the nylon band will just be better to wear all day long.
Yeah, I think it's better for the spring, summer, fall seasons than the sports band is, where the sport band is probably fine if you want to wear it during winter. I still find the sport band a little bit more comfortable, but I appreciate the look of this one a lot more, and I got it in scuba blue for my birthday from my parents, so that's cool.
Oh yeah, and I forgot to mention the color of the nylon. It's the black one. And lastly, something I just forgot to mention is, remember a while ago people were mentioning that the sports bands of different color were having different tactile feeling?
Yeah.
And I can agree on that. Like, right now I'm wearing the yellow one, and it's not greatly different from the black one that I used to wear. But the first time I put it on this morning, I felt the difference. And it's not a bad difference, just a difference.
All right. Next up, I am really happy that health is playing a much bigger role in the marketing and the positioning of the Apple Watch. And part of that is because of the sort of strange structure that this event took compared to the previous ones. So they opened up with a little word about the FBI, then they went in and talked about the environment for a while, and unfortunately I'm not going to talk about the environment this time. And then they went into health and fitness with stuff like Research Kit and the new Care Kit, which basically allows you to, allows physicians to better communicate what you should do to care for yourself after you've been discharged from the hospital or from a clinic. And what's really interesting about this is they are bringing Research Kit to the Apple Watch, and apparently the first application that is going to use Research Kit on the Apple Watch is EpiWatch, which attempts to detect signs of incoming epileptic seizures from the data available through the sensors on the Apple Watch, which is a brilliant idea, actually.
Oh, it is.
It seems like a really great use of Research Kit. And I hope that we're going to see a lot more applications like this, research applications come out of this initiative on the Apple Watch, because that is one place where having that sensor on you all day long is much, much more valuable to collecting data like that than something like the iPhone's motion coprocessor, which, yes, it's always running, but it's much more limited in what information it can report at a reliable interval to actually be useful for anything. And it doesn't actually require any active user attention, which is great. And another thing I noticed is if you go to the Apple Watch website, the website has changed significantly, and they've changed how they're marketing the Apple Watch significantly, to the point where they basically don't mention third-party apps anymore. So there are three big pillars on the Apple Watch website now. There's health, fitness, and notifications. And these really seem to be the big tentpole features that we were looking for them to tout as the big features when they introduced the Apple Watch. Instead of saying, hey, there's this thing, it's called the Apple Watch, you can run apps on it and do a bunch of crazy stuff. And then people realized that the apps were complete shit. And then they sort of forgot about the apps and only did health, fitness, and notifications. So now the marketing is much more accurate as to how people are actually using their Apple Watches in the wild. That said, I don't think that I necessarily want to give up on third-party apps, because I think there are a lot of things that could be done third-party apps if they worked reliably, and they don't work reliably. But yeah, so I was really interested in seeing that change of positioning of the Apple Watch, and it shows that Apple at least seems to be aware that they have a problem on their hands with third-party apps, and by using whiteout all over the section about third-party apps, they're sort of avoiding that thing. Also, I should note, since the new bands were released, the Apple Watch App Store has not been updated. So that means it's still been like 4 months since the last update on the Apple Watch App Store.
Oh my goodness. I'm sure we would have an Apple Watch App Store update, but nope.
I check every week, and every week I'm disappointed.
It's funny. I think we should have a new segment called Yannick Reports on the Apple Watch App Store.
Yeah, we could also do Google Docs on iPad Pro at the same time.
Oh my goodness. Okay. Let's leave that aside.
All right, your next point.
Right. I kind of want to touch a little bit more on the way that the keynote was opened. I know that Yannick just mentioned Health, which I will leave aside, but I want to mention, obviously, I don't want to go too much in deep regarding the FBI stuff. There's already tons of information about that, and it makes me sad to think about that, so I'll skip that part. But if you take just and the environment and the health initiative from Apple, it kind of shows where Apple wants to put their core values. And if you go to the Apple's website, you'll see that it's in the footer of the webpage, and it's in a section called Apple Values. So it was really nice to see that for once, the opening of the keynote was not related to how well the Apple Store are doing, how well of the App Store is doing, and all of that stuff. Same for iTunes. Because, let's be honest, we're kind of used to them doing well. And it will be really strange one day just for Apple to be like, yep, this year we close 20 Apple Stores because not going so great. That would just be really weird. So I don't think if at some point the growth is slowing down or diminishing on the retail side, that we will know about it as publicly as they are telling us with the growth. So the fact that they are like showing us what they care about as a company and what they will want to leave as a company on this earth is quite interesting. Obviously, some people might complain that it's more PR bullshit and all of that stuff. To me, it feels that Apple cares about the environment and they want to show what can be done and what they are doing, and that's really great. They obviously drop a couple of stats regarding what they do for environment. Good example of that is they say that 100% of US operation uses renewable energy, because if I recall correctly, one of their goals by 2020 is to run the whole company on renewable energy. Also, they showed, they demoed their new disassembling robot using recycling centers called Liam that will be able to identify which part of the iPhone goes to which recycling bin and all, and make sure that everything is separated to raise the recycling level or the recycling rate of Apple parts and all iPhones and all Apple devices. And it feels, I will just end on that and says that talking about environment and DL just feels like just something new. It gave the presentation a different vibe. And then we continued on the usual part where Apple introduced stuff. But in the end, you just know that Apple wants your data private, wants to leave the earth in a better place with the environment and make sure that you stay healthy or keep most data you can have on your data, your health situation.
All right.
Next point for you.
I'm going to complain a little bit.
Oh, I was surprised that after 2 points, nobody complained that much.
Right. So I'm going to complain about changes to the iPad display and in iOS 9.3. You've probably already guessed what I'm going to complain about. It's True Tone Display and Night Shift. Apple has been the leader in high quality displays for years. In fact, I would not say that they are the ones manufacturing the displays, because that's not true. They go to vendors like LG to get their displays. But they have the best panels in the business, and you can compare the phones that Apple makes to like LG or whatever, and sometimes even relative to LG's own phones, they have better displays, which is kind of weird because it's like the same company making the parts as the phone, and they go for lower quality parts than the ones they sell their competitors. Very strange. But anyway, Apple has some kick-ass displays. Now they have added a software feature called Night Shift, which is inspired by this thing called Flex, which tunes the color temperature of your of your display based on the time of day, so that if it's later at night, the light gets yellower, so that it's easier on the eyes. And there is some pseudoscience bullshit about how it helps you sleep better, but it probably doesn't. And it makes your display disgusting. But people put up with it because they would rather have this placebo effect of I'm going to sleep better and have it look easier on the eyes than have their entire display look completely fucking disgusting. And they basically just added on to the offensive pile with this new feature called True Tone Display, which basically does the same thing, except instead of doing it relative to the time of day, it uses ambient light sensors to determine what kind of room you're in, what is the lighting situation in the room you're in, and then it tunes the white balance, basically, so that it matches the one in the room you're in. The problem is, well, first of all, I hope this is an opt-out feature, and I believe it is, because I think I've seen a movie of someone toggling it on and off. But it's maddening, because now it basically means that you can't really take accurate tests of the display, because it's always going to be tuned to the color temperature of the room you're in, which is not what you want necessarily when you're tuning that. The other problem is, it seems like a band-aid on a big problem that Apple created themselves in iOS 7. They made every fucking screen in the fucking phone white. Self-induced problem here.
Oh my goodness.
They made every app that comes on the phone by default have a white background, and the only distinguishing feature between those applications is the color of the text that is clickable.
Oh my goodness.
And then they're like, how can we fix this? We really fucked this shit up. Oh yeah, well, instead of making the UI something usable, they decided to just put on the stupid band-aid feature that uses ambient light sensors and says, hey, remember when we made super accurate displays? Do you want to just throw that shit out the fucking window and use an inaccurate display for the sake of making our bad design decision better? It's unacceptable. I really hope that people realize this is bullshit. Probably they won't, because they seem to be appreciating this feature instead of being offended that all of the colors that are on this display now are wrong. Here's the thing. I would rather lose like a year of my life than fucking put up with a shitty display with bad colors, okay?
Oh my goodness.
And I am not turning on Night Shift. I'm not turning on True Tone Display. I'm sorry, Apple. You fucked this shit up.
By the way, I'm currently looking at my phone, which I don't know why, but it's kind of yellowed at this moment.
And by the way, as you may know, I have owned in the past an iPad Mini 1, which also has a super inaccurate display, but at least that one was trying to stick to the right colors. They just failed catastrophically. But it's about that bad. I would rather just, like, no. Just end this madness, please. Just put normal colors in the UI and let developers who make decisions about colors and artists who make decisions about colors and people who put fucking effort into taking photos with correct colors and all that shit. Now that goes all out of the window because you're always tuning the fucking colors. And it's madness. I'm just tired of complaining about this thing, so we should move on to your next point. But really, just end this bullshit, please.
Before we move on, I just want to mention that for the last week I've been using Night Shift, and I'll be honest, it's pretty useful, not to make me sleep better, because you know what, to make me sleep better I should just use less computers and that will fix tons of issue, but that's not what I want to touch on. It's more like when you're in the dark room with no light and the only light is your phone, using Night Shift is easier on the eyes. That's it, that's all.
And I'm not denying that. I'm just saying I would rather use a display that is burning my eyes, but with the correct colors, than use a display with the incorrect colors that is not burning my eyes.
Then continue burning your eyes without using that feature, and
I will
burn
gladly.
My eye. Good. Now that Tianyi complained about new hardware features and new software feature,
It was overdue, really.
Pardon me?
It was overdue, really. I haven't been complaining recently.
Right. It's been a while. I think we should get an award or something saying that, like, a number of days without any complaining about something.
It's been 2 weeks about, more than that, a month.
Oh, well. So my last point about the Apple event is the iPhone SE, as in general, to be honest. I've been quite surprised by what Apple decided to put inside that phone. I don't mind that it still has the iPhone 5S look. I think, in my personal opinion, the iPhone 5S is kind of the best design that Apple did for those iPhones in a while. So I'm quite happy that they are keeping this exact design for phone-inch devices. The price is pretty good, only in US dollars, sadly. They will bring all the new colors to the phone. It's the same, mostly the same spec as an iPhone 6S. It just feels to me that this new phone will just raise where the iPhone 5C has fallen. And if true, that, and I think that Apple with this exact phone has ticked the right boxes to make that happen. Because the problem, my main gripe with the iPhone 5C, it was just like, it's an iPhone 5 with the cheaper case. And sadly, people saw this plastic case, even if it's fancy plastic, as just a cheap iPhone. And yet again, it kind of shows that people want iPhone because of their quote-unquote higher quality standards and all of that stuff. And it shows that that's what people want and that's what Apple is giving them. And this is why I think the iPhone SE will be quite its own success in the 4-inch market.
Well, it basically is the 4-inch market because everybody else gave up.
Right.
And I mean, Android phone companies are incompetent and are unable to actually make a phone that is 4 inches that actually works. So yeah, it's not really happening.
Because that's the main problem with 4-inch phones outside of the iPhone is they use the smaller screen as just like, oh, it's our cheap phone. So the screen is cheap, and then you go back to what you complained about for 5 minutes, that the screen color is shit and all of that stuff that I don't want to mention again, but I'm mentioning again. And yeah, like, it still uses the old way of thinking that smaller is cheaper and bigger is more expensive. And even if the technology is there to just give mostly the same technology for smaller phones and use the same technology that is present in those higher-end phones. And hopefully, maybe it will change the way the market in the competition is working, but I don't have my hopes high. And to be honest, it's kind of a niche that Apple is having then, and they'll just rock that world and that's it.
Honestly, I'm very tempted to actually go out and buy this phone, but I won't. And the reason I won't, of course, is because it's 6 months late to the party, and in 6 months, it's going to be obsolete again, and that pisses me off. And the other thing is that there is no established pattern for when this is getting a refresh, so you can buy the phone now, and if you want to continue being on the 4-inch bandwagon, you have no fucking clue when the next phone is coming out. It could be in 2.5 years, like with the iPhone 5C to the iPhone SE. And in that case, I'd rather just put up with a stupid 4.7-inch screen, which, yeah, it's bigger. Yeah, I think about it every single day that it's too big, but I want the cutting-edge phone, and I'm willing to put up with a stupid huge display, just like I'm probably going to have to put up with a stupid True Tone display on an iPad in the future, because I want the latest thing, always the latest thing. And it's my upgrade year this year. And I'm not going to be upgrading for basically an S phone when I own the non-S phone. So there's no real point in upgrading to the SE for me because it's not a substantial enough upgrade. The only upgrade I would be getting is finally getting the form factor I want. But they're not going to be revving the SE in 6 months alongside the iPhone 7. I can guarantee that. And I think very few people are actually convinced that in a year from now, we're going to be getting the iPhone SE 2 or whatever they want to call it, or if they just stop numbering these stupid phones and they just give us a new iPhone SE with the internals of the 7. I doubt that's going to happen.
Sure. But I'll be honest with you. I think it made a lot of people reconsider this exact decision because I totally agree with you on that. Right now, if I were to update my iPhone, I will just get the new one.
And that I would pay iPhone 7 full price for a 4-inch version of that phone if it came out at the same time.
Oh, you're totally right. And you're totally right that this phone came 6 months too late for a portion of the 4-inch market.
Now, other thing that I'm fully aware of is I'm not the target market for this. It's all about Asia. Like so much of what Apple does these days, it's all about Asia. Like, screw everything else for the people over here, because Asia is the more interesting and more important market for them. And I don't disagree with that assessment. It's just that as a buyer who is not in Asia, I am sort of bothered by those decisions.
Sure, but I think it's also a move for the more price-conscious markets. And to be honest, though, it's kind of a good move for them. Like, you get a cheaper iPhone, kind of a cheaper iPhone with only 6 months old internals. That's way better than just getting a 2 years old iPhone at the same price, which was the case 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, but the problem is, if this phone stays in the cycle for 2.5 years, like the iPhone 5C does, we've got the same problem. It's just that when it came out, it was slightly more recent.
Good. Let's move to the last point, and hopefully it's not complaining about hardware again.
Well, it's 0.5 complaining. So this is the big appeal of the event for me. It's iPad accessories. And by iPad accessories, I mean basically two things. I mean the Lightning to USB-C cable, which was released, which allows the iPad Pro, the big iPad Pro users, to use fast charging alongside a MacBook One power brick. So this is the same power brick that was released for the one-port MacBook when it came out last year. And now you can use it on an iPad Pro, as long as it's a 12-inch model. I believe if you use the 9-inch model, you get slow charging. But the big iPad Pro needs fast charging because it takes 4.5 hours to charge the damn thing.
And you're right, it's only for the big iPad Pro.
Yeah, and because I use my iPad Pro so goddamn much, it's always dead. So having to spend 4.5 hours away from the iPad to do something else is not necessarily something I really like. And that is basically the only time I spend on my laptop now, is time where I'm waiting for the iPad to charge, or whenever I'm playing Destiny and I need to look at stuff. I'm already sitting at my desk, so the computer's there anyway. So
did you buy the adapter?
I didn't buy it yet. It's probably going to be coming soon, except I didn't buy it yet. Because I'm also considering the USB 3 camera connection kit, which is an upgraded version of the camera connection kit, which already existed for the iPad, which on one end it's a lightning port, and on the other you get a lightning jack to plug into your lightning port. And on the other end you get a USB port, which you can plug into other peripherals into. And one of the big issues with said adapter for many years now is that adapter is not powered. So if you want to use powered peripherals, like let's say a DJ controller, or like let's say a podcasting microphone, you can't actually do that unless you also carry along a powered USB hub and plug that into the wall, and then you've got a whole other problem on your hands. Now this adapter is powered, so there is none of that issue. As long as you have a lightning to USB cable and a USB brick, you can plug it into power and not have to carry around a stupid hub, which is great. And it means that a lot more people are able to use peripherals on their iPads than if they had to figure out this kludgy sort of hacky workaround that sometimes displays an error message telling you that your peripheral is unsupported. Now it appears it's actually supported by Apple. And even weird arcane stuff that I wasn't expecting, like USB Ethernet adapters are supported, which is really strange. And I think it was the first time that Ethernet was mentioned in an Apple keynote since like 2005. It's probably the first time in like 10, since the MacBook Air was announced probably, that Ethernet was mentioned by name on a keynote, and it was for the iPad Pro, which is really not what you were expecting probably. But yeah, so that now that's possible. Both of these seem really, really appealing to me. I just haven't decided if I'm going all in or if I'm just getting one or the other. The USB-C power charger really seems like a no-brainer. I'm just doing a little bit more research on it first. But both of those peripherals are basically the highlight of the event for me, because I'm probably not going to buy the iPhone SE for the reasons I've laid out already. iPad Pro 9.7-inch, I mean, it's great, except I have the 12-inch one, and mine has an actually good display on it. And like Apple Watch, well, I have the band, but like the band is not going to change a major thing in my life. Whereas iPad Pro, it's a pretty significant deal because it's my primary computer now. So I don't know. Was really the most exciting part of the event, which I guess is pretty damning in certain circumstances because it means literally you're excited about a power brick. But yes, I'm excited about a power brick. And this is how weird this show is. I complain about screens that are supposed to be good, and I am excited about power bricks.
Yeah, I think if we can resume what we think about the Apple event is, I was excited about Apple Watch bands. You were excited about power bricks, and you hated new technologies.
Yeah, fuck new technologies, man.
Good. Last point I wanted to touch on regarding the USB adapter is, even in the weird case you mentioned where you had to use a USB hub to get power to USB, even that wouldn't recharge your iPad while you were using those accessories.
All right, so, that's true. I forgot it recharges your iPad too.
And the new one will also recharge too. It's not a pass-through, so even if you plug it into your computer, it won't try to sync. It will only use the energy from the USB port. But at least it's charging the iPad and using the energy to power the USB devices.
And once again, please be very, very careful what USB-C cables you buy, because USB-C, unlike many, many other kinds of connectors that have happened in the past where you can buy cheap $1 generic cables on Amazon and get away with it, USB-C can destroy your device if you use a bad cable, and you should be very careful who you buy your cables from. Don't be that guy who reviews all the cables and winds up with a dead laptop every week.
You just want to follow his advice and don't be that guy.
Yeah, well, basically his advice is, I bought another $1 cable and my laptop's fried again. See you next week. Man, I should do those kinds of video reviews on YouTube. I'd be huge.
Yeah. Do you know if the power brick comes with the USB-C or it's a separate purchase?
It's a separate purchase, which means it costs like $100 to get a stupid power brick and a cable.
Oh my goodness. Okay, that's good to know. Good. I think that's it for the Apple event.
Awesome. Let's move on to the new IE.
Yeah. So this week I wanted to have a small discussion about a modern web browser. I ran into some articles that were referring to the Safari's the new IE phenomenon of last summer. And
summer blockbuster.
Exactly. And before I talk more about this new article and new take on that subject, I just want to start with which browser do we use in our personal life and professional lives. And I think I'll start with mine first. Is I've been a Chrome user for a while, like during my studies, and I don't remember why. I think the main reason was because Flash was still big at that point, and it was safer to use Flash in Chrome than just install Flash on your computer. And that was the main reason why I've used Chrome, until I bought a MacBook Air, which then I realized that Chrome is not power efficient on laptops, especially on Apple laptops. I don't know on PCs, but I would think that it's also a big problem on Windows PCs. And then I moved back to Safari and been on Safari forever. And I haven't experienced any like third-party web browser on iOS yet, because most of them are just dependent on old, like either UI WebView or WK WebView technologies that will bring you the same advantage as Safari on iOS. So I've been pretty consistent with Safari on iOS, but for the Mac, I've used Chrome quite a lot in the recent past. What about you, Yannick?
So at home, I use Safari, mainly because I am a Mac user, and if you're a Mac user, you basically should be using Safari for 100% of cases, because Chrome on the Mac is dog shit. So that's a problem. And at work, I use Chrome because we target Chrome. So I might as well be using the browser we're targeting when I'm testing it. And that is basically as simple as it gets.
Good. So before let's move on to the next point, which is let's remind ourselves what was the problem with that big Safari's the new IE phenomenon of last summer. So the article was written by Nolan Lawson, and the guy is a web/Android developer that just came back from insert name of web conference that I don't remember, and was pretty pissed about the way that Apple was trying to just, that was non-existent in the open web community, is in his own opinion. The main reason why it was pissed is Safari does not support new web technology features. And in his opinion, those new technologies are way better than the one Apple is suggesting you to use to develop web apps or websites. And as it's been a common theme in the development circle of people that use Apple technologies, the writer was pretty pissed about the current situation and the way he tried to just quote-unquote fix the decision was just to write about it because we've seen that it kind of works in the past. And then what happened was kind of I think the writer was a phenomenon. Everybody in the internet tried to chime in and it kind of became like a big fight about, oh no, Chrome is the best and Safari is the best, oh no, and all of that stuff. And that's kind of something I want to stay away from for today. So getting the backstory, having the backstory in mind right now, I just want to tackle some points of what would make a modern IE equivalent in a modern web browser. And if we remember the main way that Internet Explorers in the 90s and the beginning of the 2000s were able to get just like 80-90% of market share around the world was it was on at that time a majority of internet connected devices. And during those years, internet connected devices was also known as a Windows PC. There was still the Mac, there was still Linux boxes, but Linux boxes was still like couple of percent of PCs around the world, and the Mac was still like waving around 7-10% of market share. And if you compare that to these years with all of those with all of the mobile technologies and the mobile phones we have and even other type of internet connected devices, most of them have a web browser, and I would say that most of them have a different web browser. Each of them are kind of based on either fork or different flavors of known web engines, which will turn around either from Safari, from WebKit, the Chrome engine, the Gecko engine from Firefox, and dare I mention Opera, which is somewhere around the world.
Opera switched to using Chromium a couple years ago. Right. You're forgetting Internet Explorer, obviously.
Yeah. And Internet Explorer, that is making a nice comeback, but a positive comeback at least.
Yep.
And the second point that is kind of driven by the first one, when you have majority of market share on internet connected devices, you can start to just have functionalities that no other browser have and that they never will because it is proprietary stuff. And I think the way that all of those web standards driven by the W3C are, and all of this situation, the way it's currently managed, I don't think anybody will be able to emerge or just force proprietary technologies to other people. And that's kind of my point regarding why it's kind of hard to say that Safari is the new IE. I know that Mr. Lawson is kind of arguing that he was more using the comparison on the fact that at that time, IE was not using new standards, and B, it was a monopoly because, yes, Safari is the only web engine, Safari / WebKit is the only web engine available on iOS. And last point, secrecy around the development of this web engine. And all of those points are valid, let's be honest. But it felt to me that still it was kind of, yet again, all of those points are valid, but Safari is bad because it's from Apple. And it feels to me that during this conversation, it's always back to something like, oh, it's in the past it was IE versus the world. Now it's kind of Safari versus the world. And I don't think we're able to kind of, not forget, but like ditch that feeling. Which brings me to a recent article that I run into called The Chrome Distortion, How Chrome Negatively Alter Our Expectation. And this article resonates with me quite a lot, especially more than the Safari's and UI. And the main reason is, for my limited experience with web development, this relates what I've experienced. And the guy kind of started his article by mentioning, like, he's scoring all of the browsers compared to his own experience with them and how he likes to develop for them. And he goes on a big explanation why the fact that Chrome and the Chromium engine and the fact that they implement so much feature kind of exactly alters our expectation about what a good and modern web browser should be. And obviously he touched tons of points that one mentioned during the Safari debate, where, like, yes, Chrome has more feature, but not all of them are as performant as other browser. I didn't mention that the problem with the performance and the energy problems that Chrome has that are never seen or rarely seen in Safari is something sometimes that it's kind of ditched by developers, because, well, let's be honest, it doesn't affect our day-to-day job or day-to-day experience with developing a web application.
And I think that whenever a new MacBook comes out, I think it's incredibly obvious which reviewers use Chrome, because their battery life numbers always have an hour less than people who use Safari. And generally you can confirm this, because if it's like a video review from The Verge or something, you can actually see Chrome in their dock and Safari is not there. And I think that's like a really obvious tell to say, like, well, there's part of the problem is if you use Chrome, even just for like normal day-to-day web activity, even without Flash, you're basically cutting off an hour of battery life from your laptop. And if it's something like the small MacBook, the 12-inch MacBook, that doesn't have that much battery life, then an hour is actually a pretty sizable chunk of that, and it's a big deal, more so than if you are using like a big MacBook Pro or something.
Right. And another thing that was kind of refreshing from all of this discussion is, especially as iOS developers, is all of the lack of communication that is kind of shown from Apple's. It's nice to see that it's affecting other people that are using Apple technologies and even more quote-unquote open technology that are promoted by Apple. And I think part of the problem of all of this situation is just the lack of communication, because 6 months later, the first article was rewritten 6 months ago, and there was already updates on them that says, yeah, remember when I mentioned that Safari were not public about supporting or denying or not supporting X feature? Yeah, but if I looked at the mailing list from the W3C, I would have found a mailing list where Apple was like, yeah, we're not sure about this standard yet, we would object about this standard. And just, you realize that this whole situation is way more nuanced than it seemed to be at first.
Yeah, but I think that there were some criticism of the Swift Evolution mailing list for a while, where the criticism was you aren't going to get criticism on the Swift language from people who use Objective-C, because people who use Objective-C are probably less likely to enjoy Swift right now, so they're not likely to go sign up for the Swift Evolution group, so you're never going to get their feedback. So that kind of feedback loop can happen on the W3C and WG mailing list as well, where you have people who are not necessarily invested in, I want to help write the specs for HTML 5.1, but it would be useful for them to be aware of what the negotiation situation is going on and what the status of various proposals is. And if you don't poke your head in the mailing list, which, yes, seems like a very archaic way of doing things in 2016, but that's how many open source communities operate these days, then you're just never going to be aware that this discussion is going on.
Right. And also, during my research, it felt to me like one of the main arguments from the, let's put it this way, like on the Chrome is more open than Safari side, and Chrome / Firefox / Opera is more open than Safari, that when Apple seems to publicly object about new designs and all that stuff. When they do so, they're just like, okay, before we implement it, either we do a bad job, which is then their fault, or B, they'll just wait for the standard to be no longer a draft. And then when it becomes a standard, they'll do something about it.
Well, what's funny, though, is that when Apple proposes something, they'll implement the draft right away. And they'll ship the draft, and then they'll send the proposal to the mailing list. And people are like, well, they've already started using this all over the web, so we might as well adopt it. And that's sort of, I think, where some of the criticism of Safari as the new IE was valid, is that Apple is very aggressive in pushing their things, and they are very reluctant to adopt proposals until they have matured completely. And I think that their fears about other people's proposals are not necessarily unfounded, because other people's proposals, as we've sort of implied from our sort of trash talking on Chrome and all that stuff, is that they don't think through implications like battery life and all of that stuff when designing these things. They just think, how do we make web applications on the web possible? And battery life is like a footnote of a footnote of a concern. And I think that Apple is much, much more, whenever they design something, that is at the forefront of what they are considering instead of being on the back burner.
Oh, totally. And another point that feels to me that this situation is kind of one side is blinking an eye on specific trade-off made by the other side, and the other side does the same for the other side's trade-off. And kind of then nobody wants to be the middle ground, but the truth is in the middle ground.
And the other thing, of course, is this sort of underlying belief at Apple that the web isn't a platform that is good for application development, and that therefore efforts into making the web a better platform for web development could be better spent making iOS a better platform for application development. And I don't think it's actually that simple, because of course the WebKit team is probably way more into developing web browsers than they are into developing generic application frameworks. But I think it's still something to consider.
Right. And maybe today we got kind of a glimpse of a new future. Let's put it this way. I think in the recent one, especially on the iOS and Mac side, we kind of start to hear that things are changing, and then maybe not worry, but you'll see new stuff is coming. And I think today we got the equivalent for the Safari / WebKit side of things. Today, Apple launched what they call the Safari Technology Preview, which is a Safari build which is between the Safari build shipped with OS X by default, and less stable than this like public release, and way more stable than the nightly builds available on webkit.org. So in a way, they will be showcasing new technologies in Safari, and people will be able to download from the Mac App Store this preview. And also this preview is, since it's on the Mac App Store, it's signed, so you still can use like all of those nice features that were added recently in Safari that uses iCloud's tab sync and bookmark syncing and all of that stuff that is not available in the WebKit nightly builds. And this is kind of a reaction. I feel it's kind of a reaction to one of the main complaints that people have against Apple these days, especially on the development side, is we kind of want to know in advance what's coming, which is completely against the way that Apple wants to showcase their new stuff and new technology. They want to still keep this wow effect and make sure that everybody is wild, and when they do the introduction, then it's kind of hard to keep that wow effect when everybody knows that this new technology is coming. But it feels to me that they start to see the advantages that people were telling them that, yeah, but if you start to like be more communicative and tell us what's coming, we can tell you way earlier that, oh, there's a bug here, or yeah, but have you thought of this case that will be affecting the way that I develop my web application or my native application that you guys at Apple might not have thought about while working on that new feature? And I think it's a right step in the right direction.
Yeah, and I think that one of the things that Tim Cook's Apple has done really well is find out what things they need to be secret about and what things they don't need to be secret about. And in the case of Safari or the case of Swift, they have a lot to gain by being open. They don't really gain anything by being closed because it's infrastructure, and infrastructure isn't sexy unless you're a developer. Like, nobody is going to be really excited if they spend 5 minutes in the next keynote talking about how they support some new HTML tag you've never heard of, because that only appeals to developers, and there it would be a waste of time to actually include it in consumer facing events. And to some extent, the WWDC keynote is one of those as well. They might lean a little bit more on the developer side during that event, but it's still not really developer focused like the State of the Union is at WWDC, for example. And I think they've done a really, really good job of finding out, like, yeah, we can be open about Swift. We can be open about WebKit. We can be open about all of these technologies because they're the backbone of our products. And being secretive about them just doesn't gain anything, really.
Right. I think I'll end on that note. I just forgot to mention a point about the last article I want that I spoke, the Chrome distortion one, is with all of the news that were written regarding the new IE phenomenon of this last summer. When that happens, in my opinion, there's always somewhere on the side that will just say, like, but I have the other side of this story. And the Chrome distortion article is exactly that. And as I think as a developer, you need to be like, you need to make sure that you will fight for this other side to get the better picture, and make sure that if every news or if you're trying to find a new technology, that you're not influenced only by a specific select group of either people or technologies, and make sure that you are having all of the information to make the best judgment you can.
Sounds good.
Good. Wow. So three topics, and we were able to keep the episode quite short.
About a half hour each.
Right. I'm proud of us.
Yeah, if only we could do this every week.
Good. So let's wrap it up.
All right. You can find this episode of the podcast at limitlesspossibility.net/37, or you can find all episodes of our podcast at limitlesspossibility.net. The podcast is also on Twitter. You can follow us there at limipo_podcast. That's LIMIPO_podcast. If you want to follow me, you can follow me on Twitter at Sakurina. That's SAKURINA. And Luc Olivier is at
Lucanoche. That's LUCCONOUCHE.
Awesome. And we'll see you in 2 weeks.
See you in 2 weeks.